Today's podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
All right, let's get it going right here, right now. This is Diamond Conversations, and you are listening to episode number 6 of Diamond Conversations here on the Place to Be Nation's podcasting platform. If you didn't know by now, my name is Chad, and every single week you hear me talking baseball with somebody involved with the game of baseball, whether it's a player, whether it's a writer, whether it's an executive. It's going to be somebody talking about America's pastime with me every single week here on this Diamond Conversations podcast. But this week we take another turn down the author route as we talk to Matthew Silverman about his plethora of wonderful New York Met books that he has written over the years. And I kind of find it ironic that as I do the research for the interviews and as I kind of populate the list of guys that I would like to have on the show, it's tended to kind of have a New York flavor to it. And that is purely coincidental because there are so many great minds for baseball that I'm trying to get on the show. But talking to some of the people about, you know, the Mets and talking about the New York franchises, talking about the Yankees, it is somewhat to me, it's a fun part of learning more about the game because everybody's got a different perspective about a team, about a franchise, you know, about a legacy, about champions. And it's cool to see somebody like Matt Silverman, who being a lifelong Met fan, gives us a little bit of a perspective of what it was like to grow up during dark days of the Mets and also the glory years of the New York Mets. And in his books, which he's written a couple great ones, like Shea Stadium Remembered or Mets by the Numbers, he gives such a unique perspective about the New York Mets franchise that it makes it fun. And that's the most important part of baseball and the game itself, is having fun and bringing these memories to light and being able to share the stories that you've collected throughout your time as a fan and be able to put them on paper. That is, it's wonderful. And this chat with Matt is just, it's just fun. That's just going to be the continued word of the day, because as a Met fan myself, there's things that I can say to another Met fan that'll kind of make them laugh a little bit, because we may not have superstar after superstar. We may not have Hall of Famer after Hall of Famer, but if you're a Met fan, you have those one or two guys that you just take as like a personal favorite, and they become absolute folk legends in the pantheon of Mets lore and Mets players and Mets history. And it's kind of funny because, I mean, I can name like five off the top of my head that some people may not even scratch their head at. But, you know, for a Met fan, we kind of live and die by those guys who maybe never made it past a team in New York or had their best years in New York. And it's always a cool thing for a Met fan to reflect on those kind of those fringe players, you know, those borderline superstars for New York. But hey, we've also had our fair share of New York players that were not coming to the Mets during favorable times. And we didn't really get into that on the show, but obviously you kind of know who I'm talking about, the Met players who were superstars in other places and just came and had either a horrible first couple of years or just completely tanked coming out of the gate. And you could hear them for miles and miles. And one of those guys who did not have a great first year with the Mets was Carlos Beltran, when he came to the Mets in a very highly regarded free agent signing in 2005, obviously kind of changing the guard of the Mets franchise. Mike Piazza was ending his time there. The emergence of David Wright, Jose Reyes, but also the signing of Pedro Martinez, and then right before they acquired Carlos Delgado. 2005 was a pivotal year, but Beltran did not have a first great year in New York. But it's the press conference that Matt and I get to talk about that kind of mirrors the recent press conference where they introduced Carlos Beltran as the new Mets manager. And if you remember that at all, and the hype and everything that went into it, you can see the parallels between the two press conferences back in 2005 and just a couple weeks ago here in 2019, as we get to almost finish this year and get to 2020. I'm chomping at the bit for some hot stove heating up, the GM meetings, the winter meetings, everything right around the corner. And this is going to be a lot of fun on the podcast as we live through this for the first time. And I'm kind of planning some special roundtables and things that may be different in terms of content just to get everybody excited for that 2020 baseball season, which if you look at your watch, is just around the corner. So let's wrap it up here. Let's get on over to this interview with Matthew Silverman. But before we do, I want to throw out some plugs. If you're on Facebook, please head on over to the Diamond Conversations page. It is Diamond Conversations Baseball Podcast. Working on putting a little mini website together very soon, hopefully in 2020. And also head on over to Twitter. You can follow me at ChadENB, or you can follow the show at DiamondConvers1. And I appreciate everybody who's gone through the first 5 episodes of the show. We've got another great one scheduled for next week, but not to get past this one with Matt Silverman. This was a ton of fun, and I am just so happy to introduce this interview to you here right now. So stay tuned. We're going to talk a little Mets baseball with author Matthew Silverman. Joining me back here on Diamond Conversations, I'm very happy to welcome in somebody, and I'm not trying to stay niche on a topic here in the early episodes of Diamond Conversations, but whenever I can talk about the Mets, it's always going to be a fun episode, and I'm so ecstatic to welcome in author of so many fantastic Mets-related books, Matthew Silverman, joining me today on Diamond Conversations. Matthew, thank you for joining me.
It's great to be here, Ian.
So we talk about the Mets, right? That's the easiest topic I could possibly pick out of the sky for myself, being a lifelong Met fan. But I am here to thank you for all of these Met books that you've published over the years. So that's the first thing, is thank you before we even get into the interview.
You're welcome. Glad someone's reading.
So what is it about this team, Matt? I mean, we know what it's like to be Met fans. We know what it's like to live and die with every pitch, every player, every inning, every season. But what is it about this team that keeps us coming back for more? And obviously, the content that you've been able to create, we're dying for it. But what is it about this team that keeps us coming back?
It has a really loyal fan base. Sometimes I think now it can be almost, you know, a little whiny maybe sometimes. It sounds a little different than it used to, but I think somewhere underneath the neediness is some, hope and that this will be, you know, this next period when they get it all together, this will be the period that they finally win another championship. And, you know, they had from the earliest days, they had a really loyal fan base because they had one of the, well, probably still the worst team coming out of the gate that there has been, and were able to quickly turn it around and reward all those people who had been very loyal from the first day.
Yeah, I mean, the New York fan base, it's a National League fan base by design, by the historical aspect. But these Met fans, I mean, it just seems like, you know, like I said, we live and die with every pitch, every season, every inning. We fall in love with these players that maybe on another team might not be a superstar or a semi-star, but to us, we endear ourselves to some of these lesser-known players. But I guess it's passion, right? I guess it's the first thing we can kind of take and say. The Met fan is a passionate fan, and we're a resilient fan, and that's what keeps us coming back.
Yes, they keep getting hit and whacked down, and I think that was some of the animosity that is created between Mets and Yankees fans, is that there's always there's a famous thing that George Steinbrenner certainly pushed along, that if you don't win a World Series, it's a failure of a season. And, you know, on the other side of town, it's like, well, I guess we've been failures 58 times, if that's how you judge it. And I think, that you take the big picture because you can't win every season. And you know that it would be nice if you could contend every season, but I do think it makes the good times that much better when you can do the bad times. And when I have to say, whenever I do a book on the Mets, I especially if it's comprehensive, I always try and do something or say something about each season, just because each season is kind of its own, you know, what would you say, you know, its own existence there. And they live together with the seasons that came before and after it. And there's so many seasons that are they're similar to others. It almost seems like, you know, they just said the great fates that just said, okay, well, we'll just make this season like 1997 or something like that.
There's a lot of seasons in there that you could basically say, like, it was just as interesting as the championship years, you know, the 69, your 86. I mean, we think about 1985, it was a fascinating year. 1999 was a fascinating year. And I could even say 2019 was a fascinating year, just because, obviously, they were dead and buried, came out from literally the bellows, and almost were right in the mix there towards the end of the season. I mean, even till the last pitch, you know, keeping you on the edge of your seat this past season. But it's just something about this team, you know. I could say it till the cows come home. I could literally repeat the same phrase throughout this entire chat. But I look at some of the books that you've written. The first one that stands out to me was a personal favorite of mine, and it's Mets by the Numbers, going back about 10 years when you had that one come out. And first off, for me, it was the cover that caught my eye with all the baseball cards on it. That was number one. But I love the outline and the profiles on each guy that you had. And to me, that's such dedication. Where did the passion for baseball come from you? Was it something that you kind of inherited from a family member, or did you just take to the game yourself and just become, you know, almost like obsessed with this game of baseball?
It was actually the latter. Most people I talked to, you know, their parents were big fans, or their family was really big fans. My family was kind of, you know, they got into the whole 1969 thing and 1973, both of which kind of came before I was really paying that much attention to anything. And, you know, I was so much into, by the time I had been a fan for a few months, I was already way more into it than any of them had ever been. And, you know, made them all insane, asking them questions about everything from the suicide squeeze to what state is Detroit in, and, you know, things like that, as I tried to figure out the game. And, you know, it still amazed me that there was a team in Canada, and I probably always had a little a crush on the Expos from that point on.
That's I'm almost in the same boat as you. I feel the same way, because that's it might be a Gary Carter thing, but besides that,
it doesn't extend to the Nationals, but definitely with the Expos. And you know, they also killed the Mets for so many years.
Yeah.
But they, you know, I thought that they were very similar to, you know, a newer version of the Mets, sort of.
So who was the first player that really you got into in the Mets?
It was, you know, Tom Seaver was on the team then and all this other stuff, but it was really, you know, Dave Kingman. When I saw how far he was hitting the ball, I was like, wow, that's just amazing. And, you know, whereas the pitchers, there was like the Mets had all these good pitchers. It was like that didn't seem that surprising. But, you know, even from a point where I didn't really understand baseball that well, I was like I could, you know, identify with someone who was hitting the ball, you know, 100 feet farther than everybody else, you know, even on their home runs. And so I'd say Dave Kingman was probably my you know, still probably my guiltiest pleasure as a Mets fan, and my first as well.
So, yeah, my uncle, who was really my, he's my guide when it comes to the Mets stuff, and he always talks about the Midnight Massacre, because not only was it Tom Seaver that was traded that night, but it was also Dave Kingman. So, if you're a Mets fan in 1977, man, you're getting a gut punch and a half, because you're losing the franchise, but you're also losing Kong. So, I can imagine for young Mets fans, that being something that would kind of scar you for life if you weren't a stronger man.
Yes, and at the same time, the Yankees were had put together... they had been in the World Series the year before, and that year they had gotten the, Reggie Jackson and a couple, and Don Gullett and a couple of other big names the first time free agency came around. And they were just starting to put things really together about the same time the Mets were tearing everything apart. And 2 years before, when I sort of chose to be a Mets fan. I grew up in New Rochelle, New York, or White Plains, but I went to school in New Rochelle at Iona, and half the class was Mets fans, half the class was Yankees fans, and 2 years later it was like, you know, 70-30, and a couple years, and after they won the second World Series, it was about 90-10.
I can see that, absolutely. It's an interesting thing. Growing up in New Jersey, it was really, you know, especially in the heart of the core dynasty years in the mid-90s, I mean, you know, finding a Met fan was like, you know, it's like finding a needle in a haystack. So it's funny how in some of those tougher years, the Met fan still perseveres and manages to keep their head above water. But around 2007, when you started writing some of these Met books, what was it that led you to getting into turning to writing these? Did you feel there was a need for some direct content about the franchise that you loved? Or was it something that you were always kind of poised to do and write about a topic easy for you like the Mets?
Well, I worked for a group that did the baseball encyclopedia at the official encyclopedia at the time, Total Baseball. And we actually did one of my moment as a salesman was selling them this book that we did that we sort of scooped out of the encyclopedia. And what was it? It was called Total Mets. And when did it come out? It came out in 97, which was actually a Mets renaissance type of year, like 84 and 97 yeah. and like 2005. And, you know, hopefully in a few years, you'll be able to look back and say 2019, fingers crossed. And, you know, the thing started to really turn around. And it was, and that is how I started with that. And then a few years later, it was Mets by the Numbers, which John Springer, that was his baby. I saw it and I thought that this would make a great book, and we worked together to put that out. And it actually took so long to do that, by the time the book actually came out, I'd actually written a couple of other books on the Mets that sort of came from my pursuits around that. So and then once I did that and I had put together my own website, MetSilverman.com, the people just started contacting me to do more of them, and it sort of expanded from there.
Has there been a story that you felt needs a little bit more attention from the literary side when it comes to the Mets? I mean, you know, you look at seasons, obviously, 86, 69, you know, then the other one, 73, 2000, where they made it, 2006. Is there any other stories out there, do you think, that need to be explored with this franchise?
I have been considering it because I've the Shea Stadium book, which sort of someone came to me with. I had thought I had run through everything I wanted to write about, but you know, I think especially with Beltran being back, I think you'll see more things in general about that mid-2000s team, because you know, to see if the Mets, you know, because there's some analogies there as well. Can the Mets get it together? Can they bring in that Beltran kind of player? Can, you know, or can they bring in a sort of elder statesman like Pedro Martinez, especially since maybe they'll have an extra spot if they can't figure out the finances or outbid somebody for Zach Wheeler, that there might be some analogies to that, because that team was very close and really was one bad inning away, and that was early in that 2006 playoffs against the Cardinals when I was there, where the Mets had the game sort of seemingly wrapped up, and next thing you know, the Cardinals score four or five runs, and the Mets end up losing, and the Cardinals were in control of the series until that final. The Mets did tie it up, but they Cardinals took that lead on that. So another one that I could always consider an analogy is the Yadier Molina home run and the Mike Socha home run.
Mike Socha, yep.
Both of which I was at, and the Molina one was more devastating, but the Socha one was more shocking, I think.
The social one, it's almost like it took the sail or the wind out of the sail of that era. You know, like that mid-80s team, 85 to 88, really it was like that home run was like the changing of the guard, you know, and you started to see guys leaving after that. So it's like that ball sailing over the fence had a lot more meaning in it than just the, you know, the fact that this dominant team, you know, ended up not going past the playoffs. Obviously expected to go to the World Series, but I feel like that home run is almost more significant because it was like the end of that era, you know?
Yes, they were able to keep it together. And again, just like in 2006, they were able to tie the series, but then, you know, it fell apart in Game 7 and not much quicker than it did against the Cardinals. But you know, the team did have a couple more decent years, but, you know, the 89 team just was, just seemed to sag away. And then once they got rid of Davey Johnson, it was almost a miracle that they stayed in it as long as they did in 1990.
Yeah.
And after that, the wheels really did fall off, and they let Strawberry go, which, to be honest, if you take the rest of his career, that was probably a good thing that happened to them. But, you know, it might have saved them some bucks and some heartache, but it didn't, you know, the team didn't, it went in and done the direction and it was not a good one.
Yeah, competitive in 90 and then just fell off, you know, after the obviously 92, 93, the worst team money could buy. Not what we would call the greatest era of Met baseball in Flushing by any stretch. Now, going back to the Beltran acquisition in 2005, do you kind of see parallels with the press conference they just had for him a few weeks ago and that initial press conference where he was introduced in 05? Because I kind of felt like it had that same vibe somewhat. You know, I know it was just introducing a manager, but if you go back to 2005 and how much that press conference meant and him coming in and the words that he had that this was the new Mets, I almost felt like there were some parallels between the press conference a few weeks ago and that one from when he was initially signed in 05.
Yes, they did, and actually one of the things that that keeps me from doing much on that mid-2000s team is it ends so horribly with the 2007 and then the 2008 and the closing of Shea that I don't know that I can live through that again if it's to end the same way. So so I hope it ends on a happier note than that, but also, you know, when they signed him, they did not have as good a core as they do now. Between, you know, Alonso is there, and they've got some good young players in there, and Rosario has really shown something. Nimmo, you still don't know exactly what, you know, if he's going to be super sub or actually turn into a decent everyday player. You don't know what's going to happen with Cespedes, because if he comes back and is anything like he is, it is like signing a new free agent.
Yeah.
Because at this point, no one really expects anything out of him. They don't. Most people don't even expect he'll play at all next year. But they, you know, there was some video earlier in the week about him, or of him taking batting practice, which people point out is probably the easiest thing you can do. Is, you know, if you have bad feet, is take a few swings. You don't have to run anything out or stand around on the outfield, but, you know, it holds out a little hope, and you can hope that maybe they pull off some kind of small deal or bring up someone from the minors, and it ends up like a couple of the moves that they, you know, that they had last year that you hope pan out down the road.
Yeah, and you can compare it to a couple seasons, you know, from the past where they were on the fringe of going somewhere, whether it was an 84 or an 85 or a 98. A lot of people forget about 1998. You know, they were, again, a couple, cause just a few losses off the pace of being in that wild card mix in 98. And it's just like, is this what we're expecting here in 2019? You know, they won 86 games. I don't think in June anybody would have said that was the number they were going to win. And you can find the parallels to the past. But, I mean, maybe as Met fans, we got to stop looking to the past and just actually wait for something to develop.
Yes. The Mets being sort of a baseball version of Greek theater, where, you know, it's tragedy, it's comedy, it's, you know, it's something, where it always builds off something else. And, you know, the more of these things I do, that I put together, the more of them seem like they're sort of copies of something else and just put in a new context. So It would be nice to have a new and exciting story, but you know, you also have those two great years of 86 and 69 to throw in there, and then you know you have even some of the teams that lost in tragic fashion in the World Series, whether it's 73 or, you know, speaking of ones that are ridiculously similar, is the 2000 and the 2015 teams, which the World Series were almost carbon copies, except one was some nondescript team in Kansas City that suddenly decided to try the one year the Mets put everything together, and the Yankees, which is still I still haven't been to a Mets Yankees attended a Mets Yankees game since then, because I still haven't seen the point after that series.
Well, that's a great point. Yeah, that 2015 Royals team, looking back, it's like, man, they really just ran into a team at the wrong time in 2015. The Royals really, yeah, they decided to put it together that year. Thanks a lot, Kansas City.
Yeah, they and especially since growing up in the 70s, with the only real excitement I got from some of those years was rooting for the Royals against the Yankees, and you know, those were great series, but they never quite put it all together or put it, you know, were that resilient or venomous as they were against the Mets. So again, thanks Royals, and you know, they never resumed their 100 losses a year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it seems like that was ages ago. Now, there's a series in 98, and this is why I took to this 2019 team, because I saw those parallels to the 98 team. There's a series that they go to Houston, and if anybody who, like, I'm friends with listens to this, they know this is the series I talk about all the time. It was a 4-game series. The Mets win, I believe, 3 out of 4, but every single game, it was just like how this season was. Every pitch counted, and every single game mattered. And I think that was the fun part of 2019, but, you know, again, we'd like maybe another laugher season, like a 06, where Shea was rocking, and only the way that Shea could, like, legitimately Shea swaying and rocking, and you know what I'm talking about. When I say that, hopefully we get back to that. But I want to transition into Shea, if we can, and your last book that you wrote about Shea Stadium. I mean, just people could say what they want about the building itself. People called it a dump, but it was our dump. We love Shea Stadium. Tell us about the book. Tell us about Shea Stadium and what it meant to you.
Well, the "our dump" was the first thing that I wrote in there, because I heard it so many times, and I wanted to just address it right there. And yeah, and it was I always equated to someone's house or a place that you grew up in, and you know, except you shared it with 100 million people, and you know, it was especially in the 10 years, I really felt kind of you were able to forget about, you know, that horrible hot dog that made you sick, or the lukewarm beer, or you know, just getting ripped off, or one of my favorites was standing in line for with the coupon on the back for the Subway that they had there in the later years at Shea, and they have this coupon that's like 2 for 1. It's like, oh, this is great, and it says available everywhere except Shea Stadium. You know, it sort of had that feel to it, and you know, that'll be $20 for 2 Subway sandwiches instead, and you know that, but it was. You know, the one thing, the food has gotten better, but it's also kind of like when you think back growing up, it's like, well, you know, we didn't have the best food, or our mom wasn't a good cook, or we couldn't afford anything, you know, that was that fancy. But, you know, we all got by and we learned from it. And it sort of, I think, has that, certainly for me, has that feeling, you know, and you can still, when you go to Citi Field, if you have a few minutes, you can walk around where the bases were, and, you know, sometimes you can get a little feeling from it. You know, I kind of have that same feeling when I drive by the house that I grew up in. Every 5 or 6 years, I might feel nostalgic enough to do that. And, you know, I don't even want to pull in and look in, because to me, I'm still sitting in there, like 12 years old, watching the Mets game on, you know, in our little den. You know, in black and white, listening to Lindsey Nelson or something like that. So I don't want to mess any of that up. And it's still, you know, to me feels that you can conjure up memories like that at any time. And so it's sort of reached into that nostalgia part. And also in a world where, you know, people weren't attached to something, you know, to like what's going on right this moment that isn't going on with baseball. You know, people, mostly talking about phones, is the whole time Shea was there, you never saw people looking at their phones unless they had some business call or calling someone to tell them, I'm going to be a little late. But the people were all intent on the game. And, you know, one of the things I liked about Shea is that, and the stadiums that were built around then, is that you could go from left field corner to the right field corner and watch the game the entire time. And, it might take you an inning and a half to get all the way across if it was crowded, but it was, you know, that you could follow the game without having to watch it on a screen or do this, and you could experience it and see different people's vantage point. Now, if, you know, a city is a very nice place to see a ball game, but, you know, the whole way the ushers are completely different. You know, if I have a seat into the second row of the ballpark but want to sit to the second of the top row in the stadium, they'll say, I'm sorry, this isn't where your seat are, you know, is.
Yeah.
And Shea was sort of a free-for-all that, the only place that they really hounded you was maybe the Loge because there were so few seats and the field level. But anywhere else, you could generally just roam around like it was, you know, your place, and you could say, let's sit here today, or I want to sit out by the Tommy Agee sign, or whatever.
I just miss it. I close my eyes, and I could think it's a Sunday afternoon and be sitting there at Shea, and it's something that still, I was at the last winning game in 2008, so I got to experience it one happy time. The day before, obviously, it all ended before the doors closed, and it just ended on such a sour note. But in the book, Shea Stadium Remembered, you know, not only are we going to learn about Shea with the Mets, but we learn about the rest of the history. I talk about some of that history, if you can, of Shea Stadium, because a lot of big key things happened there. And obviously, I do a wrestling podcast on the side. Shea Stadium hosted many a wrestling event in the late 70s.
Yes, I have to admit I didn't do that much on the wrestling or the boxing for that matter, but I tried to get as much of a smattering in on different events. You know, the rock and roll is probably like the biggest thing, but I do remember them having the cage match there, and I think 1980 was one of the first big one they had, and they had a bunch of them over the years. And the concerts were interesting because when you look it up, they really didn't have that many, but they had so many big bands that came there because to the people in Europe, especially England, it was, you know, Shea Stadium was like a mecca. And, you know, so you had the Rolling Stones played there and the Who and the Police at their – the Police decided to break up while they were playing at Shea because they're like, well, we can't pass this, you know. And they broke up not that long thereafter. And one of the last concerts the Beatles played was their second concert at Shea. And, you know, so there were a lot of other things. There's a lot of stuff there about the Jets as well. And to be honest, I went to a lot of Jets games, but most of them I went to were at the Meadowlands. And there's a lot of stuff about the early Jets that I learned in there that was and when I was doing the baseball encyclopedias, we also did football encyclopedias, so I got to throw in some of the stuff from there and also just some of the kooky stuff that the Jets had. And, you know, you don't think of it, but the Jets, the Polo Grounds had been closed for several years and was like literally a giant rat hole. And the Jets had to play there for like 2 years and reopened the place before Shea Stadium was built and went back when they were the Titans. And it was there. I don't know that there's ever been a New York team that people thought less about than the first couple of years of the Titans, and they were, you know, they didn't draw, you know, more than 6,000 people. And once the Jets moved into Shea, everything completely changed even before they got Namath, and suddenly they went from being the, you know, one of the worst attended places to the top in attendance, I think, for the whole rest of the run in the AFL.
Now, how about the history of Shea itself and how the construction came along and how the city was kind of involved with the actual building of the stadium? You know, what did you get to learn about the actual construction of Shea?
There was definitely some arm twisting because it was an era when they could not have built Shea if it was just for baseball because they... You know, they couldn't imagine putting that much money into something that was just for, you know, half of a year. So the Jets were a big part of that. And, you know, there was definitely some back behind doors arm twisting. And there was even rules written in that you know about public funding for stadiums that they sort of were able to gloss over, and there was one of those political things where the person who's running, I think it was running against Mayor Wagner, was, you know, the comptroller, and he says, you know, we're not even supposed to be spending on this, and it was probably right, but people didn't want to hear it, and he didn't, you know, Wagner ended up winning re-election, and he went into, the other guy, I think Bonero, went into obscurity, and, you know, because it was what the people wanted, whether it was, you know, you can even make, analogies to politics today. That was, you know, people didn't really want to hear if that was what was happening. They wanted what they wanted. And the Mets, fortunately for them, for us, I guess, was what they wanted. And they got the team in there. I found out that whole area sort of came about during the Ice Age. So it's maybe 10,000 years old.
Wow,
or so.
Geez.
And it was from all the silt that went there, and that then spawned all the marshes and sort of they really were meadowlands, but they were filled in so long no one thinks about that, and they filled it in from the ashes from New York City, and they had a whole contract to bring in hundreds of thousands of millions of tons of ash to fill all that in, because that was, you would not be allowed to do that now. And they just filled it in. And then Robert Moses got transfixed on using that location for as much stuff as possible. And that led to the Dodgers leaving and two different World's Fairs there and the Mets, because that was the spot that they wanted. And the Mets were really in no place to argue. So there was really never a doubt that that was where the stadium was going to be. There was a doubt if the Mets would be in the National League or the Continental League, which was the whole idea that Bill Shea brewed up just to sort of force the National League's hand, and more politics as well, to, you know, play the game as artfully as you could. And even, did the National League a favor by not going in front of Congress for the antitrust exemption hearings they were having, and won an ally, and then next thing you know, the Mets and the Astros come into existence after it really wasn't given at any point until then.
Yeah,
it's short history, exactly,
and that's as we get to start to head to the wrap up. You know, it really is. It's an amazing history, and it's a stadium that not only the Mets and Jets, obviously, but the Yankees played there while there was construction going on. The Giants played there. The football Giants played there. So, I mean, it's really
all in the same season.
Yeah, and that's amazing. You know, it's an absolutely amazing thing that you look at a place that it's not just a place where a home team plays. It's like it's a New York stadium. And again, it's sad that it's gone. It's been gone for over 10 years. And looking back, you know, like I said, we're heading into the wrap up. But give me your most fond memories of Shea Stadium, either as a child, as an adult, going to a game, something you'll never forget.
Well, the first time I went to a game at Shea was with my dad, and it was a Yankees game, Yankees Old Timers Day. It was a very exciting game.
Oh, wow.
It was a game Billy Martin was announced as the manager. Like, nobody, even the players, didn't know. And Frank Robinson was the first black manager, was managing the Indians, and he batted in that game, too. And it was very exciting, but then my dad took me to, like, this nondescript day game after a doubleheader, you know, so you had, like, the Gene Kline's Jesus Alou lineup. And it was a cloudy, not really great day, and I still, that day seems like in vivid color. The Mets did win, but it was, one of the 83 or 4 wins they had that year. It didn't seem like anything that special, but, I've never forgotten it. And, and then there was, I was lucky enough to be in college when they were in the World Series, and actually went to a couple of the World Series games, not the ones anyone remembers, but it was really exciting to be there, and was there for the Lenny Dykstra home run game, which I still think is my, I might have seen the Socha and the Yadier Molina home runs, but I trade both of those And a few more horrifying memories for being at the game where Lenny Dykstra hit that home run.
That's a great one.
I don't really like Lenny Dykstra anymore, but it was. But I'm really glad he was on the team at that specific moment.
Yeah, exactly. And now, all right, we mentioned Dave Kingman being a favorite. We mentioned Tom Seaver earlier. But we're Met fans, so we all have that fringe, you know, like lovable, non-superstar favorite player. So give me one of your secondary favorite Met players of all time.
Well, I for years I've been picking for some friends of mine, and I would always come up with a favorite non-playing Met, which is, you know, as Barstool, you know, orange seat geniuses sitting in there with a Harry M. Stevens cup, you know, you know better than they do. And, you know, there was like Todd Pratt, why isn't he playing? And, you know, so I always have one of those. And Todd Pratt, like, you know, was one like Mackie Sasser. And some of them was like, yeah, the manager knows what he's doing and you don't. Many of them were, you know, were that way. But I did see one of them was Heath Bell, who I was, you know, in 2005. I'm like, why isn't this guy pitched? Why do they only bring him in these ridiculous situations? And he's on the Hall of Fame ballot now. I mean, you know, I have a better chance of getting more than two votes than he does, but you know, some of them have gone on to great things. And then there's Nick Evans, who I think I picked two different years. And he really didn't do anything, but was, you know, a fun young player that, Jerry Manuel knew better than I did.
That's what I love about being a Met fan, is you can pull all those guys off the top of your head that we either think are going to be, you know, the next big superstar, or they're just our stars. They're our lovable superstars.
Yeah, and that's, you know, the Ike Davises and the Rico Bronias.
Exactly.
And then, you know, once in a while you're graced with a bona fide star, whether it's Strawberry or Hernandez or Carter, or hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, the Pete Alonzos, or maybe even the J.D. Davises that you don't even know if, you know, if they're going to be a star or, you know, a tenth player kind of a guy.
But no love for Benny Agbayani? Come on.
And I did. I have to admit, I did. I was a big Benny Agbayani fan, and I remember going there, and when they played the Red Sox on, like, a Sunday, I think in 99, and he hit like the 10th homer in his 88th at bat that broke some kind of a record for quickest to there, and the place just went, you know, absolutely bonkers, like playoff level screaming, and there's still like 4,000 or 5,000 empty seats, but it was, you know, that was unbelievable. And I was there when he hit that home run. I was sitting in the very top of the upper deck and had to go down to the bottom of the stadium running against everybody when I realized, oh crap, he hit that out. I've got to meet them or my wife's going to kill me. But it was great high-fiving people as they're all walking, you know, the opposite way that I'm going. And, it was great. And you know, can't forget Benny, you know, kind of, a more exciting version of the Stork, George Theodore, another one of those guys that, You know, it lives on in Mets lore, even though he really didn't do that much. But everybody, you know, even if you weren't born till 20, 30 years later, like, oh, the Stork, yeah.
You know, the Stork. Absolutely. You put your shoulders up against your neck, you know, you're the Stork. So there you go.
Yeah.
It's perfect. Well, Matt, I really appreciate you coming on. And we could talk all day about these Met players, the Met history, Shea Stadium. And I'd love to have you back in the future. But before we wrap it up, please just send the listeners of Diamond Conversations to where they can find the books, where they can go back to your website, check it out, and see everything going on in the world of Matthew Silverman.
Oh, well, thank you. It's metsilverman.com, M-E-T, Silverman, and is my website about the Mets. And I also, you can pick up the book at any of your local bookstores. We all love having them on the corner, and or you can do it certainly through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any place where you find books, and I hope you do.
Hey, and there's only one good way to end this interview. We know what that is. What do you have to say on the way out?
Let's go, Matt.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed. We dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceofNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceofNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and HistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceofNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.